now back in session. Judge Hooten, Judge Connolly, Judge Riley, the Honorable Carol A. Hooten presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I understand counsel is presenting arguments from Blue Earth County in Mankato. This is the case of James A. Compart versus Michael K. Riley et al. And counsel, if you will please note your appearances for the record before you begin your oral arguments, we'd appreciate that. Also, you will each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Yeah. With that being said, we will proceed with the appellant's argument at this time.
Mr. and Mrs. Compart are present here in the courtroom in Blue Earth as well. June and Diana Compart hired attorney Mike Riley in 2001 to represent them in correcting a Scrivener's error in a couple of deeds for property that Mr. and Mrs. Compart purchased in 1997. Over the course of the ensuing 10 years plus, attorney Riley made only sporadic efforts to address these issues. Ultimately, the issues were only resolved after significant litigation in which the Comparts had to hire a second attorney to take over the case on appeal after the district court ruled against them. This court ruled in their favor and further proceedings were held on remand. This attorney malpractice case arises out of that context and out of that situation related to the real property. This may be coming later based on the procedural posture of where we're at, but I find it noteworthy that Attorney Riley has not disputed that his actions here were inconsistent with the standard of care, that this issue was not addressed for more than 10 years. Instead, Attorney Riley argued and the district court held that this claim fails not on the merits, but because it was not timely brought within the 6 year statute of limitations. Now, because Attorney Riley has failed to satisfy his burden to show that Mr. and Mrs. Compart's legal rights in disputed property were adversely, immediately, irredeemably, and involuntarily changed on or before July 24, 2012, the district court erred in dismissing the Compart's malpractice claim, and we are here today asking this court to reverse that decision and remand it for further proceedings in this case.
Is this a legal issue that's before us then today?
Yes, Your Honor. The standard on a motion to dismiss requires this court to accept as true all of the allegations set forth in the complaint, and to determine whether those allegations establish that the statute of limitations was satisfied or not satisfied here.
But isn't this a statute of limitations issue that's before us, which is a legal issue?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And don't we have to determine what the accrual date is for that would begin the running of the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, that is exactly correct, and I don't believe that there's any significant dispute here over the legal standard that would apply to that.
All right, and that's why, and I just want to make sure that we're all on the same page. Then I, as I understand from your brief, it's the sum damage rule of accrual, right? In other words, if there's some damage that has been sustained, that is what triggers the statute to run. Am I correct?
That is correct. It's been phrased some damage, any compensable damages. It's been phrased, but that's the same standard, Your Honor.
Okay.
Some damage standard.
And that some damage may be created either by financial liability or the loss of legal right, correct?
Correct. That is correct. There's no dispute on that.
All right. And now the judge found that the statute had run. That you are therefore barred from bringing whatever claims you may have. What is there in the record that indicates that your clients did not sustain some damage, or at least some loss of a legal right, once this mortgage was recorded?
Your Honor, that goes to the legal impact under real estate law of what effect the mortgage had based on the Compart's interest in the property at the time.
Well, is there any dispute, though, that the mortgage did affect their interest in this property?
There absolutely is a dispute on that. I would strongly dispute that statement, Your Honor.
Why would you do that?
So it's important, Your Honor, to look at what interest the Comparts had on the day or the second before this mortgage was entered. The Comparts did not have record or legal title to Parcel D at that time. What the Comparts had were two types of interests in that property. First, the Comparts had a contractual or equitable interest in the property by virtue of the purchase agreement that they had signed with the Larsons way back in 1997. So that's the first interest they had. The second interest they had was a what I would refer to as a springing interest through adverse possession. If they continued to adversely possess Parcel D, as they had been doing for the remainder of the 15-year adverse possession period. So those were the two interests that the Comparts had the day before the mortgage. Now, it is a critical fact, and it is an undisputed fact in this case, that on the day before the mortgage, and in fact going back several years, all the way back to the time of the purchase agreement, the Comparts were in possession of Parcel D throughout that time, including at the time of the mortgage. And that is very significant, Your Honor, because that possession by the Comparts put the mortgagee on constructive notice of the Comparts' interest in Parcel D. So the recording of the mortgage, in many cases, if there was not possession, the Recording Act would say the first to record would have priority over any unrecorded interests. But there's an exception to that where there's constructive notice, as there is here. So the Comparts' interest, those equitable interests based on the purchase agreement and the adverse possession interest, remained prior to the mortgage and after that mortgage was entered into and recorded.
I'm trying to understand your argument. So you take it back to the purchase agreement, and yet the Comparts got a deed to parcels A and B, right?
Correct.
Following that purchase agreement, right?
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
And the Scribner's error was that they just got an easement over parcel D.
So the purchase agreement provided that the Comparts were purchasing and should have obtained title to parcels A, B, and D, and that the Larsons were going to reserve an easement over D to access parcel C.
Right. So in my view of things then, with regard to parcels A and B, the purchase agreement was done with, right?
With respect to parcels A and B, Your Honor, you are correct, but not with respect to parcel D.
So you're saying that the purchase agreement trumps this title that passed because of the Scribner's error. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor. The Scribner's error caused the purchase agreement not to be fully performed, and that with respect to parcel D. So if we were here on a dispute with parcel A or B, the purchase agreement would not trump because the deeds would have covered that.
So, okay, so.
But the deeds did not cover parcel D.
Right, so your argument is that we look to the purchase agreement from 1997 with regard to parcel D.
With respect to the Comparts' interest at parcel D immediately before the mortgage, and in fact continuing all the way through until the settlement agreement with the Wolf Sellers in the underlying case. That would be a source for the Comparts' interest in parcel D, was that purchase agreement.
And do you have case law that supports that?
Your Honor, there we cite in our brief, I believe, the case law that says a purchase agreement provides an equitable interest in property when it is purchased. So that would be the case law that we would be relying on, that attached to parcel D.
So then your clients did have an interest in the property prior to 2008?
Yes, Your Honor. We had an equitable and contractual interest, and my argument, Your Honor, is that equitable interest was identical on the date after the mortgage as it was on the day before the mortgage. The mortgage had no impact on that equitable interest in parcel D.
Well, I think that's an interesting argument, but sort of I'd like to sort of go to sort of more the basic issues. Mr. Riley was hired 2001 to 2005 to clear up the title problems because the purchase agreement, even though it said your clients owned parcel D, it wasn't recorded properly. So they owned parcel D, that wasn't recorded properly because of the mistake, and he was there to fix it, right?
Correct.
Okay. Instead of fixing it, in 2008, he let a mortgage was recorded on the property, correct?
That is correct.
And do you agree with me that a cloud on a title to real estate is some damage? So a cloud, unfortunately, that's what the Court of Appeals said in 1998 in May versus National Bank of Grand Forks, North Dakota. We specifically said a cloud on a title to real estate is damage. So if that's binding law, and I assume it is, if that's damage, isn't a mortgage a cloud on your title to real estate if there wasn't one on it before you purchased the property?
First, Your Honor, if I could address the issue on that.
Go right ahead.
A slander of title claim requires some damage to have occurred.
Yeah, I'm not talking about a slander to title. I'm talking about our opinion that said a cloud on a title to real estate is damage. So if a mortgage is a cloud to your title, I would think that's damage. And if he was hired to, fix the problem and the problem got worse, then it seems to me under May, the damage occurred when, not only did he make it better, he made it worse or allowed it to get worse in 2008. So that's, under that scenario, explain to me why you win. Yep.
If you assume that, the Comparts did not have record or legal title to the property in this case at the time of that mortgage. And their equitable rights were still superior to the rights under the mortgage. So there was no...
Well, do you think the mortgage... Do you think the mortgage made their position worse or better? Did you have to go to court to sort that all out? In fact, didn't it go all the way up to us?
Related to an adverse possession argument, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It came up to this court. And that context is...
Involving the mortgage.
No, the effect of the mortgage on adverse possession came up
No, but I mean, as I understand the prior case, it was foreclosed upon, and then it got to the, and it was sold, and then the argument is, well, who really owns the property, right? People who bought it at the mortgage foreclosure or your clients because of adverse possession. Would that be a fair statement?
I believe that is an accurate statement.
Okay. Well, you know, it seems to me all that litigation gives truth to the fact that had there never been a mortgage, none of that would have had to happen, and lawyers wouldn't have to get involved, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So isn't the damage then sort of all, well, damage, litigation, you know, courts, all getting back to the fact that not only did he not clear the title, but he allowed a mortgage to be put in place on it, which certainly made their position worse than, well, I understand your position is, yeah, I guess you're saying it did make their position worse because they always had superior title, but, you know, there's having, you know, they're saying that and then there's proving that. And, you know, it seems to me your clients unfortunately had to go through all of that because of Mr. Riley's negligence. So I guess I'm having trouble understanding why this all isn't traced back to the mortgage being recorded in 2008.
Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I respond?
You may.
Thank you. The distinction there, Your Honor, is the distinction between causation and damages. I have no dispute, Your Honor, that the recording of the mortgage was part of the chain of causation. But that doesn't answer the question of when the damage occurred. I would agree with Your Honor as well that the litigation, once the Comparts had to pay out legal fees to litigate that issue, that that would have been damages at that time. But the litigation, those fees were not incurred until within the 6-year statute of limitations period. So until that happened, until the Wolfstellers took possession and came in and excluded the Comparts did not have any damage. Their rights legally remained the same, and their rights practically remained the same. They were in possession and continued to farm the property in the same way they always had until that event occurred. So while the mortgage is relevant to causation, it is not in itself damages until it had some impact on the Comparts.
I have one question, and Judge Hooten gave me leave to ask it. Did they record their purchase agreement?
No, Your Honor. The purchase agreement was not recorded.
Thank you.
All right. You will have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. I'm Joseph Gangi. I represent the respondents in this matter, who I'll collectively refer to as Riley. This court should affirm because the only cause of action in which appellants presented a prima facie case of legal malpractice was well beyond the statute of limitations. As to any other causes of action that may be alleged in the complaint, dismissal was appropriate for the two reasons identified by the district court. One was failure to state a claim based on the lack of establishing the elements of negligence in the 544.42 affidavit. The second being that the statute of limitations still barred the claims, either because the claims, all of the claims accrued back in 2008, or as far as the 2012 acts go, they still occurred beyond the 6-year statute of limitations. Now, with respect to causes of action, which is what's alleged here, multiple acts causing multiple causes of action, the appellants were required to come forward with evidence in the 544.42 affidavit addressing all of the elements of the prima facie case that they needed to support those claims. That's unique in a legal malpractice setting. That's brought up at a very early stage, and we have that in this case. We have that with the affidavit of Jack Pierce, which addressed just one cause of action that was identified in the complaint, which related back to the acts that Riley allegedly committed back in the early early 2000s. Now, when we look at that affidavit, the affidavit itself reveals that there was some damage, in fact, in 2008 with the recording of the mortgage. And, of course, that makes perfect sense because the Comparts are claiming title to property at that point. They say, we own this land. Someone else comes in and say, no, we're the ones who own the land, or we have a security interest. Whatever it is, somebody else is making a claim to their land that they claim to own. As Judge Connolly noted, that creates a cloud on title. The Comparts can, at that point, maintain a quiet title action without getting dismissed. So they have indeed suffered some damage with the recording of that mortgage. And the district court was correct in dismissing that cause of action based on statute of limitations grounds. When we go forward to the other causes of action that were alleged in the complaint, we have the same issue with the relating back of the statute of limitations back to 2008. As the district court correctly concluded, all of these acts stem back to the recording of that mortgage. Without the mortgage, there wouldn't have been a default. There wouldn't have been a foreclosure. There would not have been a sheriff's sale. The Wolfstellers would not have been involved. As the district court noted, these all relate back to the 2008 act. That's where the some damage occurred. The standard is not that there's some additional damage or some greater damage that happens later. The question is, when is the some damage that occurs? That's when the claims accrue. And in this case, that was in 2008. Now, with respect to the 2012 acts as well, we have the statute of 544.42. That was another independent basis for the motion to dismiss and for the district court's dismissal of the action. Appellant's counsel indicated that Riley did not dispute any of the acts. Well, we're at a very early stage in the litigation. This was brought on a motion to dismiss, meaning that all of the facts in the complaint were assumed to be true. And even with that, there was still a failure to state a claim based on the statute of limitations. With the addition of the affidavit, the motion also encompassed the 544.42 failure to establish a prima facie case. And that is because the affidavit is completely silent on any of the other causes of action that are alleged in the complaint. That issue doesn't have to do with claim accrual or independent acts of negligence, but with the fact that we have multiple causes of action alleged to which the appellants need to establish a prima facie case to have those survive.
Mr. Ganji, how do you respond to appellant's argument that, well, in 2008, they were no worse off with the mortgage being there than without it, because they still had this sort of equitable interest in the property based on the purchase agreement. So therefore, there was no damage because they were no better, they were no worse. How do you respond to that, Mr. Ganji?
Well, I think that's inaccurate for a few reasons. One, when the litigation finally did happen, I believe that was one of the two issues, in addition to the adverse possession issue. There was also the issue of who owns the land, and that was the district court did not say that the Comparts own the land. They said, in fact, that the Wolfstellers own the land, and the only way that the Comparts own the land is because of their adverse possession claim. So I think fundamentally the appellants are just wrong on that. But on top of that, there's also the fact that the mortgage has been recorded, and we're not looking at just the legal title to it, whether that might be in no worse or better position, but also in that they have been damaged in other ways, such as, well, now there is a cloud on the title. Now there is somebody who's making a claim. Now we do have to do something in order to secure our own title to that land. So with the statute of limitations piece, I think is rather dispositive of the issue based on the 2008 identified in the affidavit.
We would not have to get to any of that, though, if we agreed that with the district court that some damage occurred in 2008, and that's when the statute of limitations began to run. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And that is because all of the damages flowed from that 2008 act, and this court can rule simply on statute of limitations grounds. Correct.
Why should we not accept the arguments, though, that there were independent acts of negligence that would start a new accrual date?
With an independent act of negligence, under the Frederick case, you're looking at whether the new damages are solely attributable to the new acts, whatever independent acts those are, and that's not what we have here. As noted by the district court, the damages are not solely attributable to what Mr. Riley may or may not have done in 2012 or beyond. They are attributable back to the acts Mr. Riley is alleged to have committed back in the early 2000s, leading again to that 2008 reporting of the mortgage. So everything necessarily flowed from those original acts, which is why you have an accrual date for everything in 2008, and they're in fact not independent acts. And alternatively, as the district court noted, even if we're looking at them as independent acts, they still accrued in March of 2012, which is still beyond the statute of limitations period, because the complaint was not served until July of 2018. And the reason for that would be that they've suffered additional damages by these other acts, as alleged in their own complaint, through Mr. Riley's just additional attempts to clear up title and basically what should have happened a long time ago. It all kind of is all part and parcel of the same. I don't have any other comments, Your Honors, unless there's questions for me. I
just want to confirm, it's my understanding then that you are claiming that not only are the 2012 acts, the March 2012 acts, barred under the statute of limitations, but also are barred because of the failure to have a prima facie showing with an expert report. Am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, because that affidavit does not mention any other cause of action other than those identified in the early 2000s. So as far as that requirement in 544.42, we don't have anything to establish any of the elements on a prima facie case for any of those other causes of action alleged in the complaint. I know the appellants have argued that the district court erroneously limited the complaint. But that's not a fair characterization of what the district court actually did. What the district court did is acknowledge the complaint and look at, yes, there are causes of action here, but because this is a legal malpractice action and we have the affidavit in 544.42, the appellants are required to bring forth elements and establish that prima facie case. And so the district court simply dismissed those causes of action. It wasn't limiting the complaint. It dismissed causes of action for failure to comply with 544.42. And that gives the court an alternate or additional basis to affirm, which I would ask that the court affirm this case in its entirety on either or both of those grounds. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A few points that were raised that I want to address. First, I find it a bit ironic that Attorney Riley is now arguing here before you that because the district court in the Wolfsteller action didn't held that the Wolfstellers owned the property based on that the Comparts owned it only based on adverse possession, that somehow matters. when Attorney Riley litigated the case and did not raise the equitable title to the district court in the first place. The only claim he raised in the district court was the adverse possession title in that case. So I find that a bit ironic here that Attorney Riley's failure to raise an issue is now being used as a defense to a malpractice claim. Aside from that, I want to talk a minute again about the impact of the mortgage, or lack of the impact on the mortgage, and the notion that a cloud of title by itself creates damage. And I think the example of if somebody erroneously records a mortgage with a wrong legal description against a property, that's out there, say, for 6 months. Nobody tries to sell the property, nobody tries to refinance the property. The error is discovered by the person who did it, and they release the mortgage, satisfy it. What harm has happened to that property owner? None. The issue was corrected without any cost to them. They did not suffer any harm or from having to repair it or from that being out there on it. That mortgage in that case had no impact on that property owner. And the same was true here until something happened after the mortgage, until the Wolfstellers came in and interfered with the Compart's possession. So that's why it's significant, and it's why it's important when you're looking at legal rights and the loss of legal rights as being some damage, that you heed the Supreme Court's advice that that's a narrower class of case, and it needs to be closely scrutinized to what those rights actually were and what was lost. In this case, there were no legal rights that the Comparts had before the mortgage was recorded that they lost after that mortgage was recorded. Similarly, there was no legal rights that they lost in March of 2012 from the deed and the road easement. The fact is, the quitclaim deed gave them more rights. It gave them legal title that they did not have before, and the road easement did not cause them any harm because they had agreed in the purchase agreement to give that easement in the first place. So in 2012, the Comparts got more rights, not less. There was no negative effect on their rights. So for those reasons, Attorney Riley has not established some damage in the form of a loss of legal rights. Now, I'd like to also address this affidavit issue that is out there as well. Attorney Riley did not bring a motion under Minnesota Statutes 544.42 to dismiss this claim for lack of an affidavit. Attorney Riley brought a motion to dismiss under Rule 12. In fact, he brought the motion before the affidavit was even due. So that was the motion that was before the district court, not a motion under 544.42, a motion under Rule 12. And under that rule, district court was required to accept as true all of the allegations in the complaint. Had Attorney Riley brought the other motion, I would argue that there were rights that we could have had to correct the affidavit if there were deficiencies in there. We would have had the right to argue that to the district court. If this was going to be considered as a summary judgment motion and converted as Attorney Riley's trying to do on appeal on the brief, we would have had the right to submit our own evidence. That was not the motion.
You know, Mr. Let's say I agree with you. Let's say I agree with you for that. My only other question is, what were the independent acts of malpractice that occurred in 2012? In your brief, it says, you know, his failure to notify Mr. and Mrs. Compart on the clouds of title to Parcel D, the existence of a mortgage and mortgage lien were independent acts of malpractice, distinguishable and independent from his failure in 2001 to 2005 to obtain a deed. But under Frederick, you know, the factors, explain to me how applying the Frederick factors, that additional negligence gets you to where you want to go.
Gap of time, and because it was a new document that was being drafted, And because Attorney Riley improperly advised the town clerks that that would fix their problem. So we have a separation of time. We have a related to different transaction, any different document, any different project. So that's how we get to be independent, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May I briefly conclude, Your Honor?
Go right ahead.
I just have one question. All right, even assuming that these acts were done in March of 2012, why hasn't the statute run on those acts as well? Because there's a six-year statute that ran in March of 2018.
Because even though the acts occurred in March 2012, the damage did not occur until after the convert's interest in the property was affected. So March 2012, the deed conveyed to the convert's legal title, and not until the sheriff's sale arguably divested them of that legal title from the deed, was there any harm to the convert's.
All right.
So
but
the
only reason
was later.
But that, I guess it gets back to the only reason there was a sheriff's sale is because of the mortgage, right? The non-payment of the mortgage.
Your Honor. And that's relevant to causation, but it's still not by itself damage. The causation and damage are two different questions.
Okay. Thank you.
May I briefly conclude?
You may.
Thank you. When we're talking about a technical rule like a statute of limitations, it's easy to get lost in the technicalities and miss the underlying purpose that rule is intended to affect. The rule is intended to protect against stale claims. The fact of the matter is, this was not a stale claim. Attorney Riley was involved in this throughout, and to find that the Concords lost their cause of action because they had the good grace to give Attorney Riley the chance to correct his prior errors is only going to encourage people to be harsher and to not further the purposes for that rule of protecting the public. Attorney Riley was directly involved. His memory was still fresh. Nothing changed, and the application of this rule is not consistent with the purposes. So for all the reasons in our brief and discussed today, we would ask that this court reverse the district court and send this back to allow these claims to go forward.
All right. Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement. Thank you for your presentations today.